We're in trouble.
Fulton County on Health, Water, and Environment. And I would like to start with House Bill, and I promise to start with House Bill 3216. And Representative Crummell is here to give some testimony. I'm going to be inviting testimony up on that. As a number of people have come to me, and I've asked them to come too and speak on it. So we will start with Crummell. Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Jerry Crummell. I'm the state representative from House District 27, which includes Westland and Wilsonville, and runs right along the side of the Willamette River. A couple of things that you have received in earlier handout from me is a, you should have received, let me put it that way, is a project report, Willamette River Water Treatment Pilot Study from August of 1994. That was done by Montgomery Watson. From December of 1998, the preliminary engineering report for the cities of Tigard, Wilsonville, Sherwood, and the Fulton Valley Water District in the city of Tualatin. And then the March 1997 Fulton Valley Water District's Willamette River Raw Water, Willamette River Raw Water Monitoring Program from 94 to 96. And those are both an executive as well as technical summaries. Let me start off by just noting, and you'll see this in the summaries that you've received. Oh, one other thing that you've received, or should have, is a copy of the newspaper article that just came out on Tuesday in the Wilsonville Postman.
Mr. Chair and members, just to clarify, that was in your packet from the last meeting, although we didn't get to the bill, so it's not in today's packet. There's a lot to re-photocopy, but you should have it in your bill file.
Thank you. And so I just want to point out some of these things. One of the things that you will find, and it's, as I mentioned, it's stated in I believe the executive summary from 1998, is that the Willamette River is the most studied river in the state. There's been more studies done on it on more river miles than there has any other river in the state. One of the things that I would draw your attention to from the Willamette River Raw Water Monitoring Program 94 to 96 on page 2 of the executive summary. And it says that in the second paragraph there, it says, in summary, the WRRWMP did not reveal any water quality constituents of concern for modern treatment methods even during the extreme rainfall conditions of 95 to 96. The Willamette River appears to be a good source for development of high-quality drinking water. Further raw water quality monitoring will strengthen these conclusions and add to the ability to efficiently design a treatment process for this supply. The same conclusion was reached in the pilot study of 1994, and basically that study showed that the and again, I would in ES4 Executive Summary page 4, I would note that it says, again, in the second paragraph on that page, it says, the pilot study indicates that further consideration of the Willamette River as a future drinking water source would be consistent with the Fulton Valley Water District and the region's goals and expectations with regard to public health costs and effects. What they're saying, Mr. Chair, is that the Willamette River is a potable water source. And I know that there's been some concern raised about this over the last few years, and that's one of the reasons why these studies have been done. When I was the mayor of Wilsonville, we knew that we had to aggressively attack this because we needed to have another long-term water source. We knew that, since 1973, the city of Wilsonville has held a 20 million gallon a day water rights through the Willamette River. In the ensuing times from 1973 to now, what has happened is that we have relied on ground wells. And one of the problems with the ground wells is that the aquifers are dry. And so we knew as early as 1988 that we were going to need to find another alternative source. At that time, we did have some conversations in 1988 and 89 with the city of Portland with regards to going to the going to Bull Run water, and then we also looked at at that time at the Willamette River. It wasn't until 1992 that we started really seriously considering the Willamette River, although we held that water right. We had to do something to show that we were so interested in maintaining our water rights from water resources, and so that's one of the things that spurred the pilot study, because that did show some activity in trying to draw on our Willamette River rights. Tualatin Valley Water District holds a permit for 130 million gallons a day. Between the two, City of Wilsonville, Tualatin Valley Water District, you're looking at 150 million gallons a day. And I believe, if my memory serves me correctly, that the area, the region, the metropolitan region, is looking at needing somewhere in the neighborhood of 60 to 70 million gallons a day for in the next 20 to 30 years. So this would could certainly be a regional source for the communities up there to use. One of the things that I had promoted was, as mayor, was that not only could, if we eventually built a line between the cities of Tualatin and Wilsonville, that eventually not only would we be a, it would give us a short-term fix from Tualatin, but then in the long run, when we did start drawing water from the Willamette River, it would allow us to be a regional purveyor until the use in Wilsonville got to the point where it was beyond our permit, or at the level of our permit, which means that Wilsonville would have to be built out, I believe, at about twice what it's scheduled to be built out at. It's scheduled to be built out at about 25,000 residents. So I'm happy to report that, and I strongly believe that the Willamette River is a potable water source. It is, the science is there, the studies have been done that show that it is. Now, these particular studies are done at River Mile 41, which is actually just down the road from my house. It's just, if you're going across the I-5 bridge at Wilsonville, it is just about a half mile west. So as you're going, if you look to the west, it's about a half mile from there is the is where the site is that the water was drawn out of. That that point is considered part of the Newburgh Pool. Please understand that the Newburgh Pool runs from the bridge in Yamhill, which is just a little bit south of Newburgh, up to and beyond the where about where the ferry runs. So you've got about 20 river miles that are I guess the Newburgh Pool or sort of is consistent of. The other thing that I would point out is that like Portland, there are other cities along the Willamette River, and Newburgh happens to be one of them, that have the old antiquated open sanitary sewer system. What that means is that their storm sewer drains into their sanitary sewer. And when you have a heavy rain, not a good idea in the Willamette Valley, because when you have a heavy rainfall, it flushes the system. Consequently, you'll get an over a backflow of the sanitary sewer, and you'll get raw sewage dumping into the Willamette River. When this happens, in our area anyway, when this happens, of course it affects us in Wilsonville, but what they do then is that they, there's usually signs put up along the river. With regards to the, down in Portland, Portland also has the same kind of an antiquated system. And when it overflows, then of course there's signs that are put up along the Columbia Slough, as well as in downtown Portland, that it's not a good idea to be in the water. I would note, with all of us talk about how the Willamette River is not a good source for drinking water and would not be a good thing to do, it wouldn't be a good thing to continue to use the river, I would note that if you go to Wilsonville on a nice warm day, you'll find many people in their boats, out of their boats, on their inner tubes, on their water skis, on their jet skis, swimming and having all types of activities in the river. You can't tell me that they're not ingesting some of that river water. So the Willamette River is not only a water resource for us from the standpoint of a potable drinking source or a potable source, but it is also a recreational source for us. And I think that that's something that we need to make sure that we recognize in all of this. I would not want to see us ever get into a situation where we're draining so much water out of the river that we start really lowering the table. But I think that that's going to be, it's going to be pretty hard to have that happen. With that, let me just make sure that there's not anything that I didn't forget to mention. I think that with that, I'll stop and be happy to answer any questions that the committee might have.
Questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Kapoor.
Representative Kummel, to your knowledge, have there been studies done on the effects of human consumption of fish from the Lanana River?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kapoor, I don't know if there's been a direct study done with regards to human consumption of the Willamette River water as such. Most of the studies that have been done have been on the organisms in the water itself, such as the fish and that sort of thing. And looking at the sedimentation rate and looking at the different materials that are in the water as well as the sediment, and then seeing if any of those can be filtered out, which the studies have shown that they can.
Right. Mm-hmm. I'm aware of that. I just don't want people to confuse the fact that this bill that we're looking at is really dealing with the effects on human consumption of fish, and I think that it's still an important area that hasn't been addressed right now, because a lot of folks that live in my district are people that are fishing and eating these fish. So.
Well, I'm looking for that kind of information here, too, but if it alludes to it in the article, May 12th, very recent, the Wilsonville spokesman, when we had the scientists panel that was being questioned about the possibility of using the Willamette River as a drinking source. And when they were asked about sailboat deformities, referring to the fish in the Newbert Pool, it sounded like that they had been doing, and I don't know who they are, but because I haven't seen the study, alluding to it, they said the rate of deformities had declined from 74% in 94 to 13.5% in 1998. But there were no studies done between 94 and 98 due to the lack of funding. Was that a study being done by the city? Do you know what St. Carmel? Do you know who was doing that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The studies that I'm most familiar with are the ones that I've mentioned in 94 early 94, the 5-month pilot study, and then the 94 to 96 study, and then the most recent engineering report. Those were funded jointly by what's been called the Willamette Water Supply Consortium, and that involves the City of Wilsonville, City of Tigard, Tualatin, Tualatin Valley Water District, and did I mention Tigard? They were part of, and Sherwood were all part of that. I know that Wilsonville, in the time from 94 to 96, invested just a little over $1 million in the studies that have been done.
How do you know, were they studying the skeletal deformity issue?
Actually, those studies were primarily looking at the water quality and what's actually in the water of I believe they're called VOCs are actually in the water and in the sediment of the water.
Other questions?
That's me, Devlin. Oh, Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to say that obviously I think we've had the testimony here that there's two different issues, and that is whether or not the Willamette is a potential potable water source. There's been quite a few studies in that area, and most of them come to the conclusion that it is. And then secondarily, that there have been some limited studies on the fish advisories that come about because of regarding whether or not people and how they should be preparing or whether they should be eating fish from the Willamette River. And Mr. Johnson is here from the Health Department. He's been here for several of the previous hearings. If the committee has any question about that, because he may be able to point out clearly where he thinks some of the gaps in those studies are and why they're bringing this bill forward in the first place.
Questions? Thank you, Mr. Trump.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Appreciate the information. Okay, Mr. Devlin, you want to move for your
last words here? Members of the committee, on the previous day, you received the dash fours, and I believe you have a copy of them today also. What the dash fours are is a complete replacement for the bill. You can disregard any previous copies if you have the dash ones, the dash twos, or the dash threes. The dash fours are sort of a final refinement after several of our hearings. We're asked to go back and meet with certain interests and to resolve some issues, and we met with the agencies. We met with industry spokesmen, particularly pulp and paper. Talked to three different spokesmen for that industry within this building. Met with Ms. Van Atta in regards to the language that's going to be and that is in the dash fours. Some of the things that we did in the dash fours, which are different from the dash twos, the dash threes were never really considered. Is that Ms. Van Atta's suggestion, we added the Columbia flu to the potential area for study because it's not technically, obviously, part of the Willamette River, and she thinks it's an area that probably could utilize some of this study. We took Representative Gianella's recommendation that it be a portion of this be a pilot project, and it's in the dash fours. And then the chair wanted more clearly identify that we are examining existing studies and then identifying from that what additional work needs to be done, and that's reflected in the dash fours also. So the dash fours are the only item in consideration before you. They replace the entire bill, and that's where we're at this point.
Okay. And the Department of Health is here. What do we have in existing data and research and establish around what we're talking about in this bill, and that's the consumption of fish in that area.
Thank you, Chair Welch and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tom Johnson. I'm an assistant administrator in the Oregon Health Division. There is a fair amount of information with regard to mercury, but with regard to organics, PCBs, dioxins, and so forth, there's very little information that's available, and what information is available wasn't really brought about with the intention of getting data for human health consumption, human health effects. It was sort of, does the contaminant exist? For an example, there were some fish studies that were done, but the fish that were caught were different species, and the whole fish was ground up, and it was the amount of contaminant in the entire fish as opposed to contaminants in certain parts of the fish that may be consumed. So the information that does exist with regard to particularly the organics isn't very good. There is some study that is there enough to indicate that there are contaminants, but to help us with advisories with regard to the organics, we don't have much data that can really be helpful. That would be one of the data gaps.
Well, have you read the article? Did you see me there at the panel?
I was not.
Questioning? Okay, because they do cover about five of those areas, the dioxin, the possibility of the association of Alzheimer's and Parkinson's due to certain chemicals, skeletal deformities, fish livers, and some organics is involved in that too. And what was not necessarily what was missing, I guess, was a real fish study. I think there was, they certainly looked at the Newbert pool because they were doing some squawfish examination on discolored livers and found out that they were comparing that to trout. The trout have a red liver, whereas they found out squawfish has a milky brown. So it couldn't compare to trout. It wasn't apples to apples.
Correct.
So whoever had said we had a problem with fish livers, we didn't have a study there that was showing a good scientific result, apparently.
I agree with that.
We're basing something in this report from a scientists, the four panel scientists, I think that were there, four or five of them, that were being asked, they had studied some of the results of apparently some studies here, and they said that 74%, you know, decline deformities, the skeletal deformities anyway, when we're talking about fish and vertebrates, and to 13.5 in 94 to 98. So there have to be some studies going on. Are you aware of them?
Chair Welch, yes. Those, I think, were studies done by DQ, although I wish they were here.
I think I saw Roy Onan around here somewhere.
But again, the point that I would make are that those were studies done on fish for purposes other than determining the human health effect.
Okay.
Correct. That's the point that I wanted to make sure. There's a number of studies there, and I think one of the points that I mentioned in my testimony at the previous hearing was that we would like to start, the proposal here is to start with the information that's there, to analyze that, to pull it all together, and see what sense can be made of it.
Well, Tom, it looks to me that all the questions we were talking about had everything to do with human health.
Chair Welch, I think the issue is human health consumption, and there have not been studies on that.
Well, I realize the people will be drinking it versus the fish breathe it, you know. So there, as some of these things assimilated into the body, are a little different in how they react. And I know there is a concern about eating those fish, and I'd have a concern also if they had some problems of high levels of contamination. But the studies aren't showing high levels of contamination.
Chair Welch, there's inconclusive information, I think, on that point. I think one of the points from our interest in the health division, we're getting a lot of questions from public, from other agencies, from a lot of different sources, and I think it would be very useful from our point of view in a general concept to be able to answer those questions, because those questions persist.
Other questions? I want to ask them the same as Lori. Have you been in on some of our discussion so far?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Lori Onan, Department of Environmental Quality. I have caught pieces of the discussion today, and I understand it relates to what studies have been done on the Willamette, what kind of studies of the water, what kind of studies of fish. There have been a number of studies done. DEQ has participated in some of those, usually through contracted out studies. And I'm aware that there's been studies on fish tissue to try to figure out what's causing certain deformities. I do know this issue is also being discussed on the Senate side in the Senate Agriculture Committee. And when we've discussed that over there, what we've said is the results aren't conclusive as to any cause of any of those. And if people wanted to get more information about what the problems are, what might be causing it, more studies would be needed, and they can be expensive. There are certainly, well, the Willamette is a water quality limited river on the COCD list for certain pollutants, like bacteria and other pollutants that are a result of certain pollution, including the sewer overflows. And that's something that's our focus. Our focus is on looking at the water quality and how to improve that based on the clean water standards. We do believe that 3216-2 amendments address a legitimate public health protection concern, and that's not our primary focus of the agency, but we've agreed to cooperate as we do with Health Division in providing any data that could assist them in, mm-hmm. in making any determinations about consumption risk.
Other questions? I would like to give anybody else a chance here, want to give some testimony also on this and ask questions. Also, the department while they're here is trying to gain some information. I do have some problems with some of the dash four, and it happens to be in the first paragraph to begin with, and that's shall develop. We look at Health Division Department of the Department of Human Resources shall develop programs to address the health risk of contaminated water. And we're going into I think that line, to begin with, is a built-in presumption that we have contaminated waterway. And you're telling me we haven't resolved a lot of these issues, and so I would never add that. I would never allow that out of here. And just the fact that the programs gives me a little of a worry also. You know, I think a program in a singular manner there is more appropriate. So, and I need some testimony here of those who would like to include the Columbia flu, because that's the flu, and so I think there might be some people here who'd like to give testimony about that too. So.
Sure. Perhaps just one final comment that I would make is to put on the record that our involvement in this, too, is not from a drinking water point of view. This is for fish.
No, I understand that.
Okay.
No, I understand that. And that's what we're trying to differentiate here. And just information around that. Any studies that have shed light on that have been occurring. And whether or not this doesn't need anything else. Okay, thank you very much. Okay, anyone else want to give testimony? Yes, Trish? Trish Conrad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Nice to see some of you. I haven't seen you in a while. For the record, Trish Conrad here today on behalf of H2OK, which is a citizens group that can be used for Gowanus as a drinking water source. We're not an official lobbyist for them. We're not really involved in legislation, but just wanted to come and provide some information. We're not taking a position on this piece of legislation. I have just now had a chance to see the DASHBOR amendments myself and share some of the chair's concerns, as well as would like to express some of my own. The first language he mentioned, they address the health risk of contaminated water, which doesn't say anything specifically about the consumption of fish. And the program shall include each of the following, but perhaps I'm not reading all of it correctly, but it sounds to me that there was no exclusion of drinking water, and it just said it shall include those individual points, but it didn't limit them to those individual points. And, you know, as these things go, often the letter of the law isn't necessarily matching the intent, and it's construed differently down the road, so I would just like to express my concern about that. As to some of the questions about the general water quality and problems with the fish, I was very privileged to be at an event on May 3rd that the city of Wilsonville hosted. It was a panel of six PhDs, each having an expertise in a particular area addressing water quality. The first was an individual, Dean Hill, who was paid to review the prior testing that was completed by Montgomery Watson, the Portland engineering firm. He was paid to review that data and was the only paid individual on the panel. The second was Dr. Kenneth Williamson, who's an expert in water treatment facilities engineering at OSU. The third was Dr. Eugene Foster of the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality, and I would seriously suggest you have him come and address this group because he, I believe, is probably the fish deformity expert of these two. The fourth was Dr. Jeffrey Jenkins, who's an herbicide and pesticide expert at OSU. And the final person was Dr. Dick Pratt, who's the Director of Environmental Sciences at Portland State University. As to fish livers, I believe that Chair Wallace had mentioned some of the comments about the problems that they had with the methodology. And to share some of the quotes from Dr. Foster from that panel, what he said was, quote, they were calling it a normal liver at the point it was probably actually a healthy liver, he said. No sign of cancer was found in any of the fish, Foster added. As to skeletal deformities, I do believe that there was a round of testing completed in December of 1998. So again, he would be the one to more specifically address that issue. That showed that reduction from 74% to 13%+. Go on with some of his comments, he said, according to Foster, the deformities could have any of a number of possible causes. Trace metals in the water, organic chemicals such as pesticides, effluent from pulp mills, elevated water temperatures, low dissolved oxygen, low pH, parasites, or nutritional deficiency. So it could be that it isn't a contaminant in the water at all that is causing the fish deformities. And so some of the language in the amendments and the original legislation may be a concern. And then finally, that follow-up studies are being done on fish egg baskets to isolate a cause of the skeletal deformity. So I do believe the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality is currently performing additional tests. Finally, Chris.
President Devlin.
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the witness's testimony, but there still seems to be some disconnect between the testimony and what the bill does, in a sense, because the testimony is about
determining what the source is of skeletal deformities in fish. The study that's being talked about is related strictly to human consumption of fish.
Chair Walsh, Representative Devlin, if I may respond.
Yeah.
I think that because of the concerns that I addressed initially with some of the ambiguous language within the Dash 4 amendments, and that there was no exclusion from looking at drinking water or any of the other options, and that sort of does bring this into play, and if I could kind of conclude and perhaps I can bring it home to the issue and alleviate that concern, if I may go on. A few of the other things that were pointed out at that panel, Dr. Foster said that they had done some testing on general water quality between the Newburgh Pool and Canby Ferry, so it pretty much gauges that area that showed a general trend of improvement. They also determined that the testing was adequate to determine the water quality there, that the water quality was similar to the water in Corvallis, and that actually the raw water meets the EPA standards as long as you can put it through a filter for some of the bacteria like Giardia and Cryptosporidium. Now, while I do realize that the intent is to look at the consumption of fish and the impact of that on health risk for humans, my concerns about that language in the amendment is why I went off of that testimony. If I could add one more final thing. The City of Tigard established a citizens task force that spent weeks looking at many of the issues involved, not only as drinking water source, but also with the health of the fish. Dr. Dick Pratt made some comments, and our group released a news release after that, and these comments were approved by him. Included in those were testimony about the causation of Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. And in response to that, he said, although Oregon may have a higher incidence rate for Parkinson's compared to other states, he concluded, quote, there was no clear link between living along the Willamette and disease. Very few people actually live along the Willamette. Few people drink the water and even fewer eat the fish, close quote. So certainly not taking a position on this bill. And if there are any remaining questions, I would highly suggest that either you contact some of those individuals. I'm sure they'd be happy to come down. Unfortunately, the City of Wilsonville does not do on-paper transcripts of their council meetings. They only do my videotape. And you guys have plenty of things to do than sit and watch a three-hour question and answer period. And so I provide a copy of some of this information for you. Appreciate the opportunity.
Let's see. Laurie,
I have a question.
Yes.
I asked this question of Representative Crummell earlier. Are you aware of any studies that have been done on the actual human consumption of fish from the Willamette River?
Chair Walsh, Representative Tafori, I'm not aware of those studies. I think that some of the feeling was expressed by the members of that panel, at least Dr. Pratt, was that they felt that the rate of consumption was so low that they didn't determine the risk. I certainly don't want to put words in their mouth, but no, I'm not aware of any studies.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sure.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Hillary Abraham with the Oregon Environmental Council, and with me today is Sharon Nowotsky, also with the Oregon Environmental Council. We appreciate you bringing this bill back today and won't take up too much time. I simply wanted to address some of the issues that have been also raised by Representative Devlin in regards to the sort of disconnect, I think, that we've heard today on this particular issue. The issue of the Newburgh Pool, which is the one, I think, which has been spoken to primarily today, has to do primarily with the 74% of the pike minnow fish which were found have skeletal deformities. I think that issue is distinct and very separate from this issue, which you have before you today, which deals exclusively with public health risks and the risks of consuming different fish in different areas of the basin. And I think that's very important to draw that kind of distinction. The Newburgh Pool study was done primarily to determine water quality and to gain a greater understanding of what kind of contamination was in the river, perhaps in regard to swimming, recreating, but primarily for drinking water purposes. And again, this legislation does not address any of those concerns. So I want to make clear for the record that as individuals who have worked on this issue, that's not been our purpose. And Karen can fill in any gaps that we may have at this point.
Chair Welsh, members of the committee, my name is Karen Nowotsky. For the record, I'm with the Oregon Environmental Council. I think one of the things that's really key to remember about this issue is that we're not talking about water quality. We're talking about the consumption of fish over time. The kind of chemicals we're concerned about accumulate in fish organs, in fish bodies. If a person eats one today and one tomorrow and one the next day, those chemicals accumulate in his or her body in the same way. The concern here is to look at the fish, find out the amount of chemicals involved, or to look to our already completed tests, find out the amount of chemicals involved, and issue appropriate advisories so people do not consume more fish than their bodies can handle. Likewise, the pilot program is designed to identify what chemicals we have perhaps not yet looked at. The fact that these things build up over time makes them extremely destructive to small children, to nursing mothers, to pregnant mothers. A human body will try to flush out these toxins, if you're a woman, while you're lactating. That means children are consuming these chemicals that have built up in the mother's body. They're starting out with a base level of chemicals that's much higher than anyone here in this room already has. These are the sorts of things we're concerned about. These are the things we tried to address in the bill. And I want to make it clear that these are distinct issues from water quality. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to address them.
Are distinct from drinking versus fish breathing and people eating fish?
Yes. The fish, the concentration of chemicals in fish, if I may, has to do with the fact that many of these chemicals bind with sediment and move to the bottom of the river and pile up there. They accumulate. They're not necessarily floating free in the water. So if fish eat whatever fish eat, depending on the species, they're consuming chemicals that have been taken up either into the plants or into the other animal matter, again, and concentrated. So we are distinguishing this from drinking water.
Question? Captain Gino.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I didn't write your name down, I'm sorry.
Karen Olatsky.
Karen, I used to water ski that stretch of the river there years ago. And the river has certainly changed, and I know the water contamination is different there than it used to be. What I would be curious about would be how much harm could be done in just a summer of swimming, like boating and swimming, that type of a thing, rather than drinking the water or a study on the fish, because that's what a number of people are doing. They're water skiing, swimming, boating.
Chair Welsh, Representative Gianella. In its original form, the bill did address water recreation sports and possible problems for ingesting contaminated water. In its dash 4 form, it no longer addresses water contaminated recreation. It simply addresses the consumption of contaminated fish. So Section 1 puts together a mandate for an outreach program to educate the public about the dangers of consuming fish. At this point in time, there are already fish advisories such as this. I'm not sure if people can see. It shows you how the fish look, what parts you can eat, what parts you can't. The point is to get this information out to more people. And then the second part of the bill, we're asking the Oregon Health Division to look at the material that's available, determine what gaps exist, and come up with a proposal for a pilot monitoring program. So there's no longer any reference to water contact sports in the bill.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, follow up.
So basically what you would do, warning signs for the people that are fishing and two languages perhaps? Or three.
Well, some warning signs exist. Excuse me, Chair Welch. Some just already talking about here is a more extensive outreach program for people who perhaps don't see the signs. Certain communities may fish there, take those fish back to the neighborhood, sell or trade them in a barter situation. Person consuming that fish doesn't necessarily know what that sign says. Likewise, there are certain language and cultural barriers to changing habits. Simply because you see something doesn't mean you respond to it and change your habits. If certain people, certain cultures are just preparing fish in a particular manner, a simple sign over a river that appears visually to be very clean, a fish that appears visually to be normal, the sign's not going to necessarily change their behavior. We're talking about a little more extensive outreach program.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, follow up.
If it's in their language, we have a lot of Russians in that community and a lot of Spanish. If it were written in three languages, they do read, and if it were put in the basic places where they come down the banks and fish, the areas that weren't private property, don't you think that they would read that sign? I do.
Chair Welsh, Representative. Yes, I do believe that people read the sign. There are a number of
a number of good things that we all should do that we see signs for that we don't necessarily follow up on in our behavior. What we're proposing here is simply to augment the outreach program so that more people than just the person standing near the sign have the information. Children can tell their parents, friends can tell their neighbors, you know, to give information to the community so they can share it amongst themselves and educate themselves in that manner.
Mr. Chair?
Yes,
I would just also like to put on the record that I appreciate all the information about the studies that have been done about drinking the Willamette River, but this is an entirely different issue. This issue of drinking the Willamette River is after it has been treated. I mean, they're not talking about putting their cup in the Willamette River and taking a drink of it. And I think that that is a huge step here, too. We're talking about people that are eating fish out of the water. We don't know the effects of it. Well, these studies that we're getting are really about drinking the Willamette River after it's been treated. I just wanted to point that out, too, for our panelists who may not know that.
Sure. I think Cruz. Yeah.
Do you have any idea how many people are eating these fish?
Representative Welsh, committee. No, I don't, sir. Perhaps the health department can help us with that.
Again, for the record, Tom Johnson, Oregon Health Division. We don't know the exact number, but we certainly have gone to both the Columbia Slough and the Willamette River and observed people fishing, and directly to Representative Gianella's question, observed people fishing right underneath the sign and asking them, have you seen the sign? Oh, yes, I've seen the sign. It says you're not supposed to eat the fish. Well, yeah, but, you know, and this gets back to the issue that I think Karen Hawatsky was indicating. We've discovered that we need a different way of reaching these people because their cultural norms and attitudes are different than what apparently you and I, most of us perhaps, would think is reasonable with regard to reading the sign. Simply, I think one of the conclusions that we've come to is that we've got to take a different approach to get to these people in a way which is effective in conveying to them risk, even for those fish advisories that we have good studies on and have put out.
Yes.
Tom Johnson.
Johnson, what do you have in mind?
Chair Welch and Representative Gianella, I think we will talk with people in from those communities, find out what kinds of things work for them, what's effective. We'll prepare information then in pamphlet form and outreach going to them and talking, perhaps to social groups, churches, other sorts of groups to start conveying the notion to them that there are some concerns that they may not be aware of.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, follow-up.
What would you propose the cost of something like that to be?
Chair Welch, Representative Gianella, we have participated in the fiscal estimate of this, and we feel that one full-time public health educator to begin that process is sufficient at this point. None of us can tell ultimately what would be there. I really would expect that that would be effective and what is needed. One full-time public health educator. The cost, I believe for the public health educator, $96,000.
Thank you. Mr. Chair? Yes. Hillary, can you tell me, wasn't this part of this legislation part of the governor's Willamette River Basin Task Force? Can you tell me some more about that?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Kifori, that's correct. When the governor put together his Willamette River Basin Task Force, it looked at creating a set of recommendations to I'm not sure exactly what the mission statement was, but they were supposed to look at a number of different issues regarding the health and welfare of the Roanoke Basin and the people who live and recreate in that basin. This was one of their recommendations. And actually, I could read directly from the recommendations. It says, to obtain sufficient information about fish and consumption patterns within the basin to identify human health risks and to develop solutions. So that's an indication that this is yet one of the gaps that currently exists in some of our plans.
Thank you.
Sure. That's true. Just want to get a handle on a number here. Has anybody sought to determine how many fishing licenses have been bought in this population? The entire have to have a license to fish in the state of Oregon.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, I'll take a crack at it, or at least lead off. No, in fact, really identifying the population with a great deal of certainty hasn't been done. That certainly isn't anything that really we have had a responsibility for and done anything in. Our notion is to, up to this point, make information available to the public. What we're saying here is that we simply found that that isn't sufficient, that there's still, we can observe a lot of fishing consumption going on, and I think that's one of the things that we're hoping to do is get a better handle on the population, how to reach them, how to be effective in communicating the public health risk.
Sure.
Follow up.
You keep using the term a lot, but we have no numbers to define anything, so could you define what you're meaning by a lot?
Chair Welch, Representative Cruz, that I believe is what the thrust of this effort is to try to help to define that. We see the need, we have questions, we know that there's something out there. The purpose of, I think, this proposal is to begin to quantify that.
Nothing more than.
Is the health department, are you collecting information or are you starting to see any statistically significant information that indicates that people are getting sick from eating these fish?
Sure. Well, Representative Morgan, we have not looked at that specifically. There is not any anything which stands out in terms of death rates, cancer rates at this point that, you know, just stand out as red hot. However, we don't know that. The other factor is the contaminants that we're talking about as potential, don't know for sure, are those that would not have immediate acute health effect, but would be perhaps, you know, latent period, maybe as much as 30 years. What's the amount of consumption? There are just a lot of questions that we don't know. We would not expect that there would be acute effects.
I would assume that your department has been collecting data for probably longer than 30 years.
Representative Cruz, Representative Morgan, yes, that's true for the population as a whole. But to identify the population which is at risk here, we have not done that.
May I have another question? You are at the current time, you have a program in certain areas that warns people about the dangers of consuming fish in those areas?
Representative Chair, Representative Morgan, we as a health division have issued some health advisories across the state where we have had sufficient data to allow us to determine that there is a significant and a real public health risk.
And what was the nature of the data that you used to make that assessment?
Representative Welch, Chair Welch, Representative Morgan, these studies have come from a variety of different things. We, as a division, are not in the business of going out and doing sampling and doing field work. They've come from fish and wildlife studies. They come from DEQ studies and some other studies which have been mentioned here. The most accurate data, the most complete data we have, deals with mercury. We don't have very good data on dioxins and other organics, PCBs, for example.
And Mr. Chair, could I just make a comment that I'm hearing really from the health department that what you need is funding for the public relations side of your program, that you need to get the information out in a more effective way than you currently have the ability to do. And I'm wondering what exactly I think the study side of it is kind of unclear to me, but it's clear that you're feeling like the kind of job that you can do in terms of educating people about the dangers that you know about, or that you're not satisfied with the level of contact that you're being able to make with people.
Representative Welsh, Representative Morgan, there's really two elements here in this proposal. One is to do the outreach, which we've been talking mostly about. That's the public health educator, to reach the community. The other component is to make an assessment of data that does exist, identify gaps, and propose plans to close that gap or to get the data that we need. So there's really two components here. The public outreach to do the sorts of things that you were talking about, and we do feel a need to have better data on some of these other contaminants, and that also is contained within them. So there are two components to it.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just an observation. You mentioned mercury, and I don't know that that's one element that moves downriver to the end of the river where I live, but I know that I know that it doesn't dissipate into the ground or wherever. When the archaeologists came out to dig at Fort Placid, what they're looking for are traces of mercury, because the Corps took a mercury-laden medication for their venereal diseases. So when they find that mercury in the soil, they feel they will have found the true site of Lewis and Clark's encampment. I think that's a good way that mercury leaves traces. when I think about the traces that might be there, and the sturgeon I'm fishing for is the Lower Columbia, I am less excited, because I think it is a known health hazard, the consumption of mercury. And I appreciate the sponsors of the bill brought forward as a pilot program, and I hope that it might be extended down where I live, so that I think information is a good thing. Thank you.
I just had a suggestion on reaching the people. I know that a mailing could be done in those to target the people with those language barriers, and you could do that for quite a bit less than $97,000.
Thank you. Representative Taylor, actually, which book did you get that information on?
Widely not.
Anyone else want to give testimony? You want to go over your conceptual amendment?
Yeah.
But I've still got about three people to talk to before I feel comfortable.
Okay,
and you're one of them. But we want to go over these conceptual amendments.
Chairman,
it's a committee, so they know where you're headed.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, would it be possible today to move the conceptual amendments into the dash 4 and then move the dash 4 into the bill, and we'll stop at that point. And then when we bring the bill back, at least we'll have a solid document that isn't so many dashes. And we can make, if there are any changes to make from then, I'll confer with you and I'll confer with members of the committee. But we won't move the bill out of the committee today.
Or we could just go ahead with dash 5 for the next committee.
Okay.
That'd be fine with me too.
Okay. But there's a certain point in this process where...
I know. But I also know, and I have not conferred with the Senate, there is something on this subject there, and I need to... Like I have with mostly land use environmental, I do confer with them. I have not on this, and I apologize, but we have.
And with regards to this, too, I mean, we're understanding at this point it's being referred on to Ways and Means. It's not going to the House floor. So it's got a long road.
It does have a lengthy road.
Well, let me just go over the conceptual amendments and see if people would be okay with those. in section 1, line 5, if you have the dash 4 amendments in front of you, the amendments are pretty limited, but they more clearly define the scope. It would say then, resources shall develop a program, deleting the S from programs, to omitting address and inserting examine the health risk of contaminated, deleting water, inserting fish. Then in line 12 and 13, it would read from, I'll read the whole back, or the section 1. The establishment of system to assess the public health risk resulting from consumption of contaminated fish, period, eliminating resulting from water contamination. And that's the conceptual amendment. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Any other recommendations from committee members?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Ms. Morgan.
I'm wondering if I'm looking at line 15, small a, if that is kind of, you could read into that there needs to be a study of the extent of the problem, the scope of the problem, or if adding something like that would be worthwhile.
Mr. Chairman, what were you thinking there?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I might be able to comment.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's conceptually yet, but it's probably identifying the level of health risk from, or some qualifier within that. And I think we can work on that.
Okay.
Identifies the level of public health risk.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chairman, I would ask one thing in this process. This is actually getting well beyond Representative Atkinson's trespassing bill in terms of number of drafts. I want to confer with the chair before it starts back, and I hope it starts back. It would have to be Wednesday's meeting because I couldn't get dash amendments out by Monday. That the chair will actually move it on to Ways and Means because I really don't want to go through this again and bring 4 or 5 witnesses for the 5th meeting on that if I plan to move.
And I'll know by Monday.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you very much. I appreciate your indulgence, sir. Okay. Close the hearing on House Bill 3216. I want to open the hearing on the Senate bill here that we brought back up from last Senate Bill 301.
Mr. Chair and members, Senate Bill 301 exempts certain changes in industrial use from requirement to comply with water right transfer process. If quantity of water used is not greater than rate originally allowed and not greater than quantity of water diverted to satisfy authorized specific use, if the location is owned by the holder of the original water right at time of issuance and the person who makes the change submits required information to the Water Resources Department.
Yeah.
And
301. Okay, do we have the 301? We need the sponsor to come forward. And the department.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the record Tom Byler with the Water Resources Department. Being passed out to you is a written testimony on this bill, which explains that this bill as printed. This is a department bill that we developed prior to the session working with our stakeholders and our commission. The bill as printed involves an issue relating to an industrial use water rights. And the underlying purpose of this bill, and this idea is to provide some equity to holders of industrial rights who may be suffering some inequity out of no fault of their own, but through kind of an evolving administrative approach to issuing industrial rights. I might give some explanation and background on this. As you know, every water right is designated for beneficial use. Industrial water rights, that's the one type of beneficial use. They could be issued for very specific industrial uses, such as boiler purposes or saw cooling, or they could be issued for an industrial use, a more general type of use. In past years, the department would, on occasion, issue rights for very specific uses. In more recent years, we encourage water right holders to seek industrial uses to apply for a more general industrial use. The reason for this is that it provides them with greater flexibility in terms of being able to change their processes over time. For those folks or water right holders who have a very specific industrial use, changing practices would require them to seek a transfer of that use in order to adapt to the new technology. What this bill proposes to do is to allow folks who are in that situation to not have to go through the transfer process, but instead they would be able to change from the specific industrial use to general industrial use, provided that certain criteria are met. The bottom line criteria is that they are not able to expand the use, that is, to use more water than they were entitled to in the first place, nor would they be able to use water in an area larger than the ground that existed at the time that the original right was issued. With me today is Dee Bridges, and he worked very closely on this issue, and got him an opportunity to discuss this as well. And we'll answer the questions that you might have on this. I might add a couple things, though, that this bill did pass through the Senate Water and Land Use Committee unopposed and unopposed on the Senate floor.
For the record, I'm Dee Bridges. Dee Bridges of the Oregon Water Association. We represent a number of forest products industries, forest products companies on water matters. Tom covered it pretty well. I might cite a couple of examples. You have received a copy of my testimony, and I won't dwell on it. It pretty much just repeats what Tom said. Also attached there are included is the testimony from Ed Hendricks, one of our members of Land Industries. Ed talks about some specific examples. Ed testified on the House side, but is in South Carolina today and won't be able to do it on the Senate side, won't be able to testify today on the House side. So I've given you his testimony that he gave you before he left. I want to talk about just a couple of examples that might be familiar to you. A lot of these water rights were obtained many, many years ago, and they may have been obtained for, let's say, a steam sawmill. And, there's hardly any steam sawmills. I don't think there are any steam sawmills around anymore. They still use, maybe there'll still be some. They still use water, but a lot of them have been converted to electricity, and they still use water for other purposes, but it's not for creating steam to run the machinery. They may need water for boilers or other things. Another good example might be where a mill, and I can think of a couple examples, my company that I was with previous, where they started out life as a sawmill, and on the plant site itself, they built a basin, let's say a veneer mill or plywood mill, and over time closed the sawmill down. Well, they're using the same amount of water, using the process to do what they're doing and making a different product out of it. Another example could be where the water was originally required for a log pond, and that log pond has since been filled in, and they converted to dry land log handling. You do not need the water, of course, for the pond anymore, because it doesn't exist, but you do need it to sprinkle the log decks to keep them from checking, tracking. That's really all I wanted to add, other than what I have in my written testimony.
Now, we've got the dash ones and dash twos.
Yes. Chair members of the committee, and I'm happy to explain those if we're ready for that.
Can you get that done on the Senate side?
Chair, unfortunately, those issues didn't come up on the, these issues did not come up on the Senate side. They're rather late-breaking news. If I may, the Dash 1 amendments are relate to an issue that we've worked on specifically with the City of Vail to resolve an issue they have. However, the amendment itself would apply statewide, and we think it would be a tool to add some flexibility for folks who are interested in making what we call surface-to groundwater transfers. This is a very special area of the statute, which allows folks who have a point of diversion on the surface water source to make a transfer to a groundwater source. And typically, the transfers would not allow a change of sources. It has to stay on the same source of water. And in this instance, it, we're able to do it because we have a special language in the statute which makes sure that any time that this transfer occurs, the impact of the groundwater diversion or the appropriation similarly affects the surface water as the original surface water plan diversion did. So there is basically it's a very similar effect ultimately to the resource. And provided that that transfer has that similar effect, these transfers happen. The situation that this bill or the Dash 1 amendment attempts to resolve is a scenario where a water rights holder wants to move off of the surface water source to the groundwater source. It turns out that groundwater appropriation affects a second stream. The statute doesn't contemplate that situation. And again, in the interest of maintaining kind of a similar effect and status quo, this amendment would allow for that water right holder an opportunity to mitigate the impact on that second source, that second surface water source. It's pretty straightforward. It will definitely help the City of Vail in their situation. We see this as something that will be helpful in other areas of the state, in particular the Chute State, where there's a very significant connection between surface water and groundwater sources. We can see this thing popping up again. It provides some flexibility and tool for folks to be able to make these types of changes.
Mr. Chair?
Good morning.
Could I ask you, in the Dash 1 situation, can you give me an example of that, of how that would apply?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, I'll try, and I'll use the City of Vail as an example. They have an old surface water right that, and for municipalities in particular, I think this could be an important thing, to move off of the surface water source to a groundwater source. I think the water generally is of wilter quality, and there are less standards to adhere to in terms of water quality issues. They are in a situation where they want to move off of a surface water source and into a well, groundwater. We, in preliminary studies, have found that there is a similar impact from the groundwater source than to the original surface water source from which they are moving. Therefore, complying with the standard that we have for the statutes on this particular type of action. What is unique in the situation is that we also have found that, or they also found, that that well affects a separate surface water source, another river altogether. And in this instance, the municipality is in a position where they can mitigate the depletion of flows from that second surface water source from another water right they hold upstream. And they would be able to move water into that stream, the second stream, in order to mitigate the effects of the well.
May I have a follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, follow-up.
So if you were in a Dash 1 situation, you would be entering into some kind of mitigation loop with the Water Resources Department to assess this and figure out what the best solution was to negate the effects that you were having on whoever it was that was affected?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, yes, that's correct. We would look closely with them to determine to determine whether there was any impact on another historic surface water source and to help them find a way to resolve that and mitigate the impact.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I have a concern about how long this is going to take. Are these the kinds of things that are required to happen on a short turnaround, or is there time to kind of stage this and look at all of the situations that could arise and try to figure out what's going to happen?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, I think there's plenty of time. It will be in the interest of the holder of the water rights to take a careful look at the situation. Excuse me, I'm not following the question, there are certain timelines under when one enters submits the transfer application that one would have to go through. But there's a lot of preliminary work that can be done to resolve any questions about mitigation. I don't think I'm answering your question very well.
Well, no, I think you're doing okay. And then the Dash 2 amendment, run through that again real fast.
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, I haven't touched on those yet, and that's significantly different process, but it actually deals with surface water to groundwater issues as well. This amendment is actually part of another bill on the Senate side, Senate Bill 93. At this point, we don't know where that bill will go, and the proponents behind this in Water for Life, and our podcast is in here, but you may want to saddle up here and chat about this as well. This issue involves what we're calling a substitution, and basically involves a primary and supplemental water rights scenario. Primary right is when a water right holder has a primary and supplemental right, basically the primary right is the first use that one would use. The supplemental is exactly what it says. It supplements the primary right. It can either, when you can't access the primary right for whatever reason, perhaps senior water rights have limited the use to that primary right, supplemental right can come in and augment that use, either to replace it because it's not available, or to make up for any deficiency in that primary right. Given that scenario, in the Dash 2 is about a situation where you have a primary right, a surface water right, and a supplemental right that's a groundwater right. The Dash 2s provide an opportunity for one to substitute those two rights in terms of their status as a primary and a supplemental right, in effect switching them so that the primary right is now the groundwater source, the former supplemental, and the former primary right on the surface water would become supplemental. This was brought forward in the interest of moving the primary right off of surface water sources. I think the proponents behind this idea recognize that given this day and age and under the Oregon plan and the increased pressure on the surface water source, that this was a way for folks to maintain a steady source of water without having to impact surface water sources. We're supportive of this idea. Again, it was attached to Senate Bill 93, which passed out of the Senate Water and Land Use Committee.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Would the holder of the water right have the opportunity to go back and forth between the supplemental right and the primary right, or once you made the choice, would it be that way forever?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, no, it would not be that way forever. In fact, it's contemplated in the Dash 2 amendments. First of all, this would not be able to be possible if there were ever any injury to another water right holder. But more squarely on your question, if the water right holder or the water user in question here wanted to revert back
that would be possible too. Like, you would just have to make that request to the department.
Okay.
That's okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't want to belabor this, but I just am impressed with how difficult water law is. And I looked at the Vail situation, and the part that we have in the ORS about resulting in stream depletion of at least 50% of the rate of appropriation within 10 days of continuous funding. They've done this model. They found that going to groundwater will cause a little impact on the on Bully Creek, the tributary from which they've been taking, I mean, a tributary of the Malheur from which they've been taking it. How is it actually going to be mitigated in the end? How, what does this mean, the 50% of the rate of the appropriation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Taylor, it's not only is water law difficult, but the actual physical aspects of water and how it moves is an extremely difficult thing to pin down. You correctly identified this 50% over a 10-day period. It's a model, and it's an approximation. It was a determination that the legislature decided some years back when this regulation was put in for a way for us to gauge and determine how or what in what instances that movement from the surface water to the groundwater source adequately affects the, but has a similar impact to the surface water source in order for the kind of status quo in terms of the.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, but what it means is that the city is going to have access to that amount of water, or that only that amount of water is being depleted.
Mr. Chair, Representative Taylor, under this scenario, they would in the transfer of the right, they would have the same amount of water available to them. In this particular situation, in order to mitigate the impact on the second surface water source, they have another water right altogether that they would use, and okay, through a canal they would be able to mitigate that.
I'm getting there. Thank you. Thank you. Yes, I just had one question on line 21. I think I know what it means, but if you'll just explain that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ginella,
mitigation.
Page 1?
Mm-hmm. Page 2. Page 2, line 21. Am I on the wrong dash 1? Am I on the wrong one? I only have dash 1.
Okay.
Are you working from dash 2?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ginella, I'm happy to address the dash 1 if that's where you're putting your interest in.
Basically wanted to know what that line meant. I think I know what it means, but if you could just tell me what require mitigation measures mean.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ginella, involves the dash 1 amendments, and it, again, the city of Vail scenario, and it this is the operative language which would allow persons who are making these surface water to groundwater changes to mitigate impacts to a second surface water source, that is a surface water source other than the one that they're transferring from. Under the current law, there's no way for anyone. If one impacted another surface water source, they would be unable to make this kind of a transfer. So this is the operative language which allows an opportunity for these folks to mitigate any depletion from the second surface water source.
Mr. Chair, Dee Bridges again. I just wanted to add one quickly that the City of Vail, you received a copy of a letter from their engineer I wanted to say that the City of Vail is a member of another organization that I represent on Water Oregon Water Resources Congress, and I wanted to say that we also support that amendment.
The Dash one amendment.
The Dash two amendment was submitted by Water for Life. Water for Life, I believe, we have no problem with those amendments.
Water for who?
Oh. Water for Life.
Okay. And so we have Todd Hedegerton and Captain Vanetta.
When I'm thinking about it, Chair Welch, members of the committee, Captain Vanetta, Governmental Affairs Manager for the Northwest Pulp and Paper Association, here before you today to talk about the original Senate Bill 301. Northwest Pulp and Paper supported that bill on the Senate side. And we believe quickly that it is a rather delightful bill in that it provides regulatory flexibility to facilities. And in this day and age, so much of the time, that's something that we seek, but we're rarely able to find. While it also provides protection for the in-stream water use in that you cannot expand your use of water. So it provides regulatory flexibility while providing protection for the in-stream water use. We urge that you support the original Senate Bill 301, and we take no position on the other amendments because they would not affect us.
You could have said they're pretty good.
They're delightful amendments.
Great. Okay.
Mr. Chair, Richard Coates, Stan Water for Life. Speaking in favor of the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 301. They, as Mr. Byler explained, they are contained in a bill that seems to be languishing, and that's why we're before you. I think they're fairly straightforward amendments and provide the department and water users enhanced degree of flexibility, which we would appreciate.
Okay. Question? All right. Doug Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I am Doug Myers, representing Water Watch. I'm here today to
watch or water watch?
Water watch. We are okay on the printed bill. We're okay on the Dash 1 amendments. So I'd just like to address the Dash 2 amendments. These are part of Senate Bill 93, as Tom Byler explained earlier. And we had, believe me, very long, many days negotiations in a big work group on the bill. And Water Watch applauds Water for Life for trying to put more water in stream because that would be the effect of it, of course, if you transfer water from the surface to a groundwater source, that leaves more water in the stream, and we applaud that. But the bill needs some standards, and I apologize, I don't have these in writing, let alone LC'd, but I have talked with Dee Bridges very briefly, with Tom Byler very briefly, and with Water for Life very briefly, and the standards would be on page 2 of the Dash 2s, under sub 4, following line 9, after that word section, that we would suggest that the director may approve a substitution, and by substitution we mean of the groundwater source from the surface water source, only if it would result in net benefits for in-stream values, or instead of values, we could say flows. And I haven't even had time to ascertain much reaction from the other players in this bill, but perhaps if we could get another day or two on this, we could see what they would say to that. But just that
would be right after line 9 on page 2.
Right.
Would you read that one more time?
The director may approve a substitution only if it would result in net benefits for in-stream flows.
Mr. Chair, may I comment on that?
Yes.
in your opinion, would the addition of this preclude a holder of water rights from switching back to an in-stream use after they had switched to a supplemental water right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, we understand that, and we would be okay with that. We would not object to switching back. That's part of the deal.
Would you be amenable to changing your amendment so that instead of saying only if it would be a net benefit, to say that if it would have no detrimental impact or something like that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, we would prefer, and really since it's being sold as a benefit to in-stream flows, we would really like to see this say that it would be a net benefit for in-stream flows. It should show some increase in the flow in the stream. And the director could determine that through whatever rulemaking process that she or he in the future would come up with.
Justin Morgan?
But by saying that it has to result in a net increase of water in the stream, is that in effect what you're saying?
Yes.
How is that going to actually happen? I mean, how is that possible? They're going to have to give up something else that's unrelated to this?
No, Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, the director would look at the application, for example. Say the applicant said, I'm going to switch from surface water to my groundwater source.
Mm-hmm.
And then the director would look at this and say, yes, that will result in a net benefit to in-stream flows, and approve it.
Okay. What would happen if the inverse happened? If they wanted to change the primary source back to the stream?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, that is also part of the bill, and they would do that probably because the groundwater source was in some sort of drying up or something, and therefore they wanted to take it from the stream, and that's part of the bill, and we understand that.
But doesn't that contradict the amendment that you want to put in there?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, that would take place sometime in the future, I would think. We just couldn't keep going like this. It would all depend on the reason for why they wanted to switch back from the ground to the surface water.
So certain reasons would result in benefits and certain reasons wouldn't?
Maybe Mr. Kosasan could explain, Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, as to why they would switch back. That would help.
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, Richard Kosasan, Waterfield. This probably would be one of the few times I would ever disagree with Eric Myers. But the language suggested and put forth by Water Watch, to me, would be somewhat overly restrictive, somewhat arbitrary, and I think very, very difficult to actually demonstrate in application. For example, out of stream appropriator diverts water from the Columbia River and moves to his supplemental or her supplemental source, the groundwater source. This determining the net benefit for in-stream value. Is there more water in stream? We would argue the answer is yes. Is that nearly impossible to quantify? I think the answer is yes. This is simply intended to allow some flexibility moving from primary water rights from a surface water source. Theoretically, if this works and in application works as the way we believe, we're going to have water, increased amounts of water in stream for in-stream flows and for secondary appropriate, a benefit to everybody.
I would think that it would be very important to protect a water right holder's right to go back to the primary source and suffer no net loss for doing that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, I believe that the amendment as we worked on as part of a work group and as
contained in 93 and as contained in the Dash 2 amendments provide that. But I think it should also be recognized that the amendments in terms of the substitution provide an injury set. So there is protection inherent in those Dash 2 amendments.
Yes, thank you very much. Mr. Meyer, I'm having difficulty envisioning a situation in which one gives up taking water out of a stream in exchange for groundwater. It wouldn't result in more water in the stream. Do you have some examples in mind that behind your proposed conceptual amendment?
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkel, I don't have specific ideas in mind. Our Water Watch's point is simply that there should be some standard in the bill. If it's that obvious, it should not be much of a problem to show that when you transfer from a surface water to a groundwater source, perhaps they're interconnected in some way. Perhaps the groundwater source is connected, as it is in the Deschutes area, to the surface water source. And if they do that, it wouldn't result in a net benefit to the stream, and indeed could harm downstream users.
Mr. Chair, can I explore a moment or a second point? It appears to me your proposed change would not affect the subsequent language in the bill for reverting back, because it still says upon termination of substituted primary and supplemental water rights to revert back. And so is it your intention, Mr. Myers, to leave in place the ability to revert without a test?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, yes.
My problem is we can assume our connectedness between groundwater and surface water, and it's logical to assume that, but a lot of that is pure theory at this point in time. And it varies by region, it varies by the type of topography. I mean, there's so many variables in it. And it seems to me you're asking for a level of science that we don't currently have, because we can make the assumptions that, you know, you can have some groundwater that's going in an entirely different direction and connects to a water system in an entirely different way, and so we really, I guess what you're asking for is something I think is going to be virtually impossible to prove, isn't it?
Just
15
minutes. I'm interrupting. Somebody wants to. We've been through this one. Well, I'm following up on your point. I think the question that arises with the language that you presented was only if it would result, and it doesn't clarify what one does to show it would result. Is it your intention for that to be in the judgment of the water resource instructor?
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, yes.
So this could say the director may approve a substitution only if, in his judgment or his or her judgment or the water resources director's judgment, it would result in net benefits for stream flows. Your intention is not to have someone present a scientific study showing X amount out of this stream, X amount of groundwater will filter back in, so on and so forth.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, that's a very good point that I should have said. You're absolutely right. We do not intend for this to be conclusive proof that there will be net benefits in stream. It's merely a judgment call with whatever standards the department wants to set up. They do this. They've done this for years and years. That's something they should set, and it would be a judgment call on the part of the director or his or her designee. And I do recognize the water law is very difficult. Madam Vice Chair and Representative Cruz, groundwater is especially difficult. I was once part of a task force on aquifer storage and recharge, and it was one of the more amazing learning experiences of my entire life as to what you can actually put water in a hole in the ground and then take it out later. Apparently you can.
Okay. I know what you're getting at, and I'm not much sure it does, but I just think you're asking for a pretty speculative judgment here is my problem with it. And, and we are trying to come up with better science behind these relationships, and we don't have it yet. I think if we had the better science, then something like this might be appropriate. I just don't think that we have the science or technology to actually get to where you wanted to get yet.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, all Water Watch is asking is that they use their best judgment, because that's what you can do. We have some science, we'll have better science, but judgment in any water right granted, or whether it's surface or ground or whatever, they have to use their best judgment as to whether to give out that right.
And in the Constitution, I think that the Water Resource Department is trying to use their best judgment. We represent our waters of the state.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question about if this is in Senate Bill 93, why are we having it on both sides?
Mr. Chair, Representative Taylor, this bill or this provision was contained in Senate Bill 93 and remains contained in Senate Bill 93. Rather critical issue to some individuals that we've dealt with. We're not certain as to the future fate of Senate Bill 93, hitting in ways and means, and that's the only verb.
More political
questions. All right. Any other questions? Okay, thank you much. I close the hearing on Senate Bill 301 and open the work session in Senate Bill 301.
I move dash one amendment to Senate Bill 301.
Anthony Cruz moves dash one amendment to Senate Bill 301. Any further discussion?
Mr. Chair, would it be in order to move the conceptual amendment to removing the dash one? Never mind, I withdraw my point.
Okay, any opposition to dash one? Hearing none?
Mr. Chair, yes. I move the dash two amendment to Senate Bill 301.
Representative Cruz moves the dash two amendment to Senate Bill 301. Any further discussion?
Mr. Chair,
Representative Murphy.
I'd like to move a conceptual amendment to dash two.
Okay.
State
your point.
Consisting of the following language on line 9 of page 2. The director may approve a substitution only if, in the judgment of the director, the substitution would result in net benefits or in-stream flows.
Could you give us that point one more time?
Yes. Page 2 of dash 2, line 9. The director may approve substitution only if, comma, in the judgment of the director, comma, the substitution would result in net benefits for in-stream loans. Mr. Chair,
Representative Murphy moves a conceptual amendment, as he has read, to dash two amendments to Senate Bill 301.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Morgan.
I would be not supporting the conceptual amendment. I think that there is an extremely strong risk here of water right users losing the rights to use the water. And I think that the benefit issue is dealt with in the dash one amendments, and it's also dealt with in policy within the Water Resources Department that's regularly exercised.
The chair believes these are overreaching. Any other comments?
I would agree.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, I'd really like to see a little giving in this committee on consideration of some of the minority members' concerns. I was approached by my next-door irrigator legislative neighbor, and he told me he hoped that I could support the bill that they were bringing before us that would allow for more in-stream flows. And it was really on the basis of that I considered this to be a really good idea for all concerned. I don't see the measure as proposed by Representative Merkley to be that restrictive. I would really appreciate members considering it as a compromise, which I think we've seen too little of here in some of the measures that have gone out of the committee.
Okay. Nothing. Cruz.
I would submit, Mr. Chair, that the Dash 1s and Dash 2s are compromised as they were amendments arrived at in the Woodbridge, which is what Woodbridge 3 is compromised.
I noticed that we've got the date of 5/10 on these amendments, and I have the, as a past chair of this committee that I served on the last two sessions, it reminds those. We have a very strong working group here in which Water Watch is a member. And they finally come up with a bill. Everybody's been working on it. Last minute, conceptual, either side, many times are not adopted. We do have a strong working group here and a working relationship.
Oh, Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
I guess I see this as simply stating the intended effect. I quite frankly have a difficult time imagining a situation in which a change of this nature doesn't increase in-stream flows. It's hard to envision if you're no longer taking water out of the stream and you're taking it out of the ground that you would do anything other. Water does move, however. There may be cases in which the groundwater that's being taken as a replacement may feed a tributary and have some critical impact that the department might be aware of, as opposed to the in-stream water coming from a different stream. I think it seems to me like the burden of proof here would be on only in extraordinary situations which are brought forward as causing something other than the intended effect, and this would give the director the ability to not have a perverse impact, the unintended impact of hurting the stream flows if such a case were to arise. So it seems extremely modest request. And in the spirit of what Jackie has spoken to, Representative Taylor has spoken to, I would ask for the support of the committee.
I guess my problem is sub 4 on that page right above it. It says that the director can deny the substitution if the proposed substitution will result in injury to other water rights, which would include in-stream water rights. And so in-stream flow is already a consideration. I think what we're adding here is a very vague judgment category and something that is set fairly well in place. And I think with what is in the Dash 2, the in-stream rights certainly are protected.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
In such a situation, it would seem like this proposed change could do no harm based on the reasoning Representative Cruz has presented. I would like to ask a question. I think it's a reasonable question, though, that's been raised. If I could ask Representative from Water Watch a question.
Doug, if you come up and answer a question, please.
Thank you.
Representative Cruz has raised a reasonable question as to whether the language just above it, which, since there are in-stream water rights, I don't know if there are in all circumstances, but notes that there's protection of water rights. Does that satisfactorily address the concern that you've raised that we could have a situation that actually decreased net surface water?
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, first let me tell you why I'm coming in at the last minute. The Chair has a good point, but the Director of Water Watch has been out of town until 2 this afternoon and dispatched me this stuff, and that's why we have this. Otherwise, we did get them Wednesday at 1. Second, Representative Merkley is correct. Not every stream has in-stream water rights. Some in-stream water rights that have been applied for have been protested by, for example, Water for Life. They're in limbo. And so I would just suggest that there are lots of streams without in-stream water rights on them in the state of Oregon.
Could you name some?
Representative Welch, Representative Cruz, I could by Tuesday.
Don't have that long
for Monday.
Will clerk please call the roll?
On the conceptual amendment.
On conceptual amendment.
No.
No.
No. No.
Excuse.
Go ahead. I don't think I understood it.
Keep going. We'll let her have a chance to adjust it. Excuse.
Can I be allowed to vote for the absent members?
That's right.
Aye.
For one, I'll vote for one.
No.
No.
Farewell?
No.
No.
Not having required number of votes, the conceptual fail. A motion on the table is, the fourth is the draft amendment to Senate Bill 301. Any further discussion?
Mr. Chair, I will oppose the dash two amendments. They're already in another separate bill. And they should stand or fall on their own merit, I believe.
Okay. Clerk, please call the roll.
Aye.
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 Mr.
Corey? Excuse. Mr.
Murphy?
Aye.
Mr. Morgan? Aye.
Mr.
Taylor?
No.
Farewell? Aye.
Having required number of votes, the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 301 pass.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Cruz?
I move Senate Bill 301 as amended to the floor for the pass recommendation.
Mr. Cruz? Moves Senate Bill 301 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Hearing none, will the clerk please call the roll?
Aye.
Aye.
Excuse.
Aye.
Excuse.
Aye.
Aye. And the required number of votes, Senate Bill 301, as amended, passed as well as due pass recommendation. And Currier, who would like to say it? Representative Morgan will be the Currier. The close of the hearing on Senate Bill 301. And we open a hearing on Senate Bill 465. We have Dan Lee, Oregon Water Resource Counselor, and the Department Navy. You want to come up with it real quick? We lose Dan. Okay. On 465.
Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm not Dan Lee.
Looks like you're not.
Dan had to leave, and I promised a kinship. I know just enough about this bill to be dangerous, but I'm going to do the best job I can. I'll start by saying that it came out of the Senate 27-0. It has no opposition of any kind anywhere that we're aware of. It makes a number of changes to district election laws. Presently, the voting in irrigation districts is based on land ownership of patrons who are subject to the charges or assessments of the district, and the bill makes some changes to that. Clarifies, for example, that non-patrons of the district do not have voting rights. Another thing Jan wanted me to talk about was that currently when land is excluded or included in the district with subdivisions, the district must be redistricted or reapportioned and new directors elected. This bill eliminates that automatic requirement, substitutes a deviation test. Subdivision of districts, it clarifies existing provisions for the subdivision of districts and the increase in the number of directors. And two provisions that are deemed by bond attorneys to be obsolete are repealed in sections 27 and 30.
Can the department is okay with this? Yeah, I got a nod. And any questions, let's see.
This looks like the quintessential housekeeping bill.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
here I am. Senate Bill 465, ultimately hearing. Work session. Excuse me.
Sure.
465. Yes, you need action.
Move. Senate Bill 465, as well as the DPAS recommendation.
Representative Atkinson moves. Senate Bill 465, as well as the DPAS recommendation. Any discussion? Hearing none, will the clerk please call the roll?
Aye. Yes.
Excuse? Mr. Gino? Aye. Mr. Corey? Excuse? Mr. Murphy? Aye. Mr. Quinn? Aye. Mr. Taylor? Aye. Aye. And this final number vote, Bill 465, Act 4, 3 pass recommendation, and a carrier. Let's in action, carry. So ordered. Okay, we've got, that's right, you probably sent in for
I'll give you that as well.
And two more. That's still your Senate Bill 759. We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 759.
For the record, Mr. Chair, D. Bridges, again, Senate Bill 759 is another bill having to do with irrigation district subdivisions. Basically, the major change in here is that the current statute indicates that when there are three or more tracts on each acre of land within a subdivision, that subdivision must be excluded from the district and cannot be provided water service. This is the current law. Exclusions from this process include districts providing potable water supplies and districts providing water in subdivisions, two subdivisions in an underground pipe irrigation system with meters. What the change does is that it allow it and makes it specific and clear as to what the requirements are that have to be met for subdivisions to receive water delivery. And those are that the developer must provide for underground pipe system from point of delivery to each lot, a meter, a measuring device at the point of delivery for each parcel, adequate easements for the delivery system to be installed, provisions for maintenance and repair of the delivery system, and other measures necessary for efficient water. Supply delivery and administration, we should continue to retain the right to not accept delivery to the subdivision that's provided. So again, that was one that has no opposition. It came out of the Senate 30-0.
Everybody's worked on this, the department doesn't have any opposition.
I believe they're fine.
Don't know of any.
I'm going to move it. Yep.
I move Senate Bill 759 to the floor to do pass recommendation.
Representative Cruz moves Senate Bill 759 to the floor to do pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Seeing none. Clerk, please call the roll.
Aye.
Yes.
Aye. 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 Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Close the work session on Senate Bill 759, and we open the work session on Senate Bill 1098.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Dean Bridges, representing Oregon Water Resources Congress again. This bill is one that I know a whole little about, so that's just my...
Yeah, it's worth the able... Party, yeah.
With the able assistance of the department here, I think I'm going to pass the ball here.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record again, Tom Byler with the Water Resources Department. Senate Bill 1098 is an Oregon Water Resources Congress bill. It basically extends some temporary provisions to the served water statute. One of those programs that a state agency has that it truly could be said to be one of the win-win programs. Yeah, the served water program provides an opportunity for folks to engage in greater efficiency to conserve water and to be rewarded for those efforts by being able to use water that they utilize through the conservation for new purposes. Under water law, folks are limited to using water under their rights to the extent they're ready, willing, and able to do so. This notion is contrary to conservation and efficiency improvements, because if someone makes improvements to their delivery system to the extent that they're no longer able to carry the amount of water under their original water right, they'd be subject to losing part of that water right. The Conserved Water Program provides a mechanism for people to make those efficiencies, their system, to conserve that water and to use part of that conserved water for new purposes, whether for any purposes they would want. The two amendments, or the two issues involved in this amendment, are pretty straightforward. One basically would allow folks who may have engaged in or created or developed the efficiencies of the system without first going through the program to be able to retroactively get into the program and take advantage of that opportunity. The second change basically allows for an optional priority date for the use of that water. Under the regular statute, the new water realized through the conservation has a prior date of 1 minute after the original water right. Under this scenario, the person who undergoes this program could have the same date as or the 1 minute after. The reason that this is necessary involves situations where you may have streams that have rights that have the exact same priority date, and many of those rights for the exact priority date. That being the case, 1 minute after could really negate the usefulness of that conserved water. This is an issue that has particular significance for the Tumalo Irrigation District, where they're working on a very significant project in the Deschutes Basin, which would allow them to engage in greater efficiencies in their conveyance systems. Which would, under the Conserved Water Program, add a lot of in-stream flows. By having the same priority date as the original water right, that would make the Conserved Water useful in that situation. under this bill, the temporary provisions would expire in, I believe, 2003.
Right. I'm sure if I could add two more things. One is that some low irrigation district he was talking about, but there's $1.5 million federal grant hanging in the balance that they need to build in order to get that grant. The other thing that I wanted to say is that this, again, has had no opposition. It came out of the Senate 26-0.
Very good. That's been approved.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1098 to the floor for due pass recommendation.
That's been approved. I move Senate Bill 1098 to the floor for due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Hearing none, will the clerk please call the roll?
Aye. Aye.
Aye.
Excuse.
Aye.
Excuse.
Aye.
Morgan.
Aye.
Taylor.
Aye.
Sherwell. Aye. And 5-minute vote. Senate Bill 1098 has the floor to pass recommendation. And that's the crew will be the chariot. So moved. So ordered. And the next one here for action will be House Bill. We'll open the work session, House Bill 2560. What we're doing is moving the amendment into 2540, 2500.
Okay.
And the work session on House Bill 2540.
Okay.
Okay.
I move the dash one amendment on House Bill 2540.
We have already worked on dash one amendment. They are what were in 3500, and it was the Rexway Prep that brought us 2540, and they worked in another committee and got it, so we could give it back to Prep in the form, because he worked on it, everybody else worked on it, passed it from 3500, so we're giving it back to Prep and his bill, 2540. That's all it does. And the amendments are from 3500. Is that right?
Mr. Chair and members, that's correct. If you remember, this is the youth camp issue that got a lot of attention, and they came to a consensus and had amendments for 3500. These are the exact same thing drafted for this bill, it gets and stuff, 2540.
Press relaying cause conditions there.
So, Mr. Chair, could you refresh our memory of the acceptance or non-acceptance by the Farm Bureau?
Good question.
Mr. Chair and members, I don't recall the Farm Bureau
testifying.
There was a broad work. Yeah, and the season came up for a hearing on 3500 a couple weeks ago, and there were a bunch of Boy Scouts, and there were some people from Chief County, Jody Roan, and I talked with her several times on the phone, and there seems to be broad consensus. Representative Lundquist's office did an excellent job.
Do you have a copy? For some reason, I just missed
sure.
Mine, but it, okay. What all we did here, is when you look at it, was a
criteria.
Yeah, and it's a lot of people said it was a do nothing, but they got to a point where they this is about all in the group, work group they could agree on. So it just makes the land zone forest use, makes farming forest use consistent with rules adopted by LCDC. And in section 3 gives us a date and some adoption of rules by the department. And that's what they all agreed about as far as they could go.
So. Okay.
Thank you very
much.
Now,
Mr. Chair? Yes. What is the history here? Then this was a different bill, and now we're getting it?
Yeah, it was 3500. First, that we had worked on and had several hearings on. And we moved it into, and it was Rexney Prep, as you remember, brought it to us in 2540 and worked on it. Along with Representative Lundquist and I think a couple others in the work group. And we're just putting it back into press bill.
Mr. Chairman, are there amendments?
Yeah, it was a dash one amendment that we're moving into.
They're already in it?
They're in your packet.
In your packet. And I'm going to put mine in another packet here.
You actually gave them to me.
Oh, did I give them to you?
You want them back?
Oh. Yeah, I'll put them back in my pocket. Okay.
So, Mr. Chair, again, to clarify, the original bill required approval of a church camp, and we had a whole discussion of a controversial church camp located out in
Illinois. And that won't be repeated.
Yeah, Elver in Deschutes County.
The original language of the bill is no longer there.
And now we have, we're instructing LCDC to develop rules.
Right. That's what the work group decided that they could all agree on.
And we have LCDC's support for this?
Yes, they had been in here and said, because they were in the work group too, that thing like that. And we did not change anything from what that work group agreed upon in 35 minutes.
There's a motion on the floor.
There's
a
motion on the floor there.
Okay. In the opposition? Okay. Clerk, please call the roll.
Aye.
And then the required number votes, the dash one, the amendments to the House Bill 2540 are approved.
Okay. I move on House Bill 2540 as amended to the floor with three pass recommendations.
Representative Cruz moves House Bill 2540 as amended to the floor with three pass recommendations. Further discussion? Hearing none, will the clerk please call the roll?
Aye.
Aye. And the required number votes, House Bill 2540 as amended has the floor to pass recommendation, and we will assign this to Representative Crowe. So ordered. Close the work session on House Bill 2540, and we'll open a hearing on House Bill 2979, and will be our last bill for the day. And those who have brought us the dash 5 amendments, please hold
it. Mr. Chair, members, let me explain in your packet. I tried to conceptualize the dash 5 amendments by characterizing them as the dash 4 with concept language, simply because we weren't sure we were going to get these in time. So if you read the explanation of the dash 4 with concept, that reflects my passion.
Paul's over here.
Mr. Chair and members, for the record, Paul Hanneman, Cloverdale, Oregon, speaking up for the seafood processors and a member of the original waterway task force. Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair and members, I want to thank you and the committee for bearing with us on this bill through several hearings and work sessions. And also Christina for helping us out with the amendments today. In a way, Mr. Chair, the longhand amendments are convenient because in five areas it shows you where the old language was a little more easily than if it had been engrossed again, or dash five. Mr. Chair and members, there are five rather significant things that have happened to the bill since Wednesday when you looked at it last time. The first is that there's no separate school fund anymore in the bill, and that's been deleted. Division of State Lands had objection to that. The second one is that the inventory is still in, and the proponents feel that an inventory of waterway leases really must be completed someday. and the bill calls for that date to be 2001, end of the biennium. The third one, Ms. Chair and members, is a rate equity clause, and I'll refer to the page numbers in a moment. That's on page 4, but the rate equity replaces the rate schedule that you had in the original bill. The division felt that the legislature should not be setting rates specifically, and new language has been added. Number 4, there's a review panel of stakeholders to consider hardship and discriminatory rates that currently exist. The sponsors feel that that part is necessary and it should stay there. And 5, it establishes policy and not rates. And we believe that legislative policy should be established. And it's the legislator's right and responsibility to do that, even though our lands, both in rangelands and waterways, are the primacy of the Division of State Lands and the State Land Board. Ms. Chair, if you wish, very briefly, I'll run through the pages and indicate where those changes are, even though you can see them, but perhaps you wish that I wouldn't do that.
Okay, sure. It'd
be helpful to me because I'm having trouble reading.
Okay.
Reading the words.
Very quickly then, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Page 1 is preamble, and the only change in longhand is on line 23 and makes no significant change in my viewpoint. Now, page 2 is preamble, and the small school correction fund is deleted. Page 3.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Where were we? Page 2, what line? If you don't mind.
I'm sorry, I should have pointed it out. On page 2, the change is line 25 through 30, and all that language is out. On the longhand correction, it should have lines drawn through it. 25
to
30. Yes, yes.
One clarification, where does the money go into the...
It goes where it does now, to the main account of the Common School Fund.
Okay.
After administrative costs for administering the waterway lease program.
Okay.
So no separate account. Page 3, section 3, unfortunately has a date changed. Page 3 has to conform with page 4, and mine shows a dark shadow. Yours may show a yellow highlight. The proper date should be July 1, 2001, not 2000 on line 4. The first number on line 4 should be 2001, and that conforms with the next page in page 4 in a moment. In that paragraph, on lines, beginning on line 5 and line 6, there was a problem with the language and the way legislative council drafted that before. The paragraph reads, now beginning on line 5, on or over state-owned submerged and submersible property, in an effort to identify structures that may be eligible for lease, license, and registration. It's concise, and that's the way it ought to read. And the language on line 7 and 8 relating to the school fund is not there. It's removed and stricken. The rest of the page, Ms. Chair and members, is inventory and unchanged. Page 4, it's significant. that the proponents of the bill feel that the language is significant, that the rules not be adopted by the division until that inventory is completed June 30th, 2001. Language is also added that's a little hard to read in longhand. Until the inventory is completed on June 30th, 2001, revenue derived from submerged submersible lands may not exceed the revenue derived from such lands in the previous two-year period.
Mr. Chair, if you might jump in there, but thank you. Mr. Hanneman,
yes.
Section or the small four, just prior to the changes you read,
yes.
The division may not adopt any rules regarding lease rates until the inventory is completed.
Yes.
Is that your intent still, to preclude the adoption of any rules until 2001?
Yes. The division does have some latitude to adjust the leases that they currently have now, even though in some cases they may be in midterm, by negotiation with the leasee. Those that are excessive, as we feel some of them are to the point of being oppressive, can be adjusted, but we believe that the division should not be adopting rules now at this point, when the legislature still has this bill under consideration, if it does, and that there are more significant rule adjustments and amendments that need to be made than the division proposes to make in June.
That was my next part of my question, was in by this measure we would be precluding the completion of work that we called for in a previous legislative measure, which was that they would examine the rates and come forth with the I don't know what the language was, but a completed rate structure, which they are in the process of doing. So we would abort that process.
Mr. Chair and Representative Taylor, about 4 years ago, the land board on its own action decided to appoint the waterway task force, which gave some guidelines, in which some of us were a member, to the division's rulemaking program. It was assumed that some rules would be adopted there.
I don't recall any legislative
If we're correct, there was no other legislative directive. There may have been, Ms. Chairman, Representative Taylor, budget notes that directed that rates be adjusted. We could be mistaken, but I don't believe the legislature itself called for these rules specifically that are now proposed for June adoption. If I may, Ms. Chair, on line 16, 17 and 18, instead of the rate schedule, we propose language that calls for equity, because that's what the task force called for, and you may agree with us that equity's in the eye of the beholder, and what those rates ought to be, but the division objects to the legislature setting rates by class, even though they may be uniform as the task force called for, and they may be more simple as the task force called for, but we rested on this language, and given the division the directive to set those lease rates based on the on an equitable basis. So we say using standard appraisal methods for submerged and submersible lands, the division shall seek rate equity within each class of property and among all classes of property. That's about as far as we feel we can go and provide some flexibility. The next change is the top of page 5 and was a legislative council problem that should have given a leasee with financing provisions plus 10 years, not the way they wrote it. And the school fund is out, again, lines 5 through 11. There are no other changes from the dash 4, excepting on page 9, and that's, again, the school fund on lines 12 and 13, and that's out. Mr. Chair, that's the extent of the amendments that we've proposed.
And Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir. Same one.
I have a question on page 4.
Yes.
The language, line 4 through 7. It says that the revenue derived may not exceed revenue derived in a previous two-year period.
Yes.
I'm assuming that there have been some lease changes between 1998 and 1999, and therefore, if 1999 revenue is higher than 1998 revenue, there's automatically going to be, without any additional changes, there's automatically going to be higher revenue during the next two-year period than there was during the last two-year period. And so I'm not sure how one would implement this. How would you decide which leases to decrease if it's not your intention to decrease specific leases or to refund money in some way? Then this needs to be clarified.
Mr. Chair and Representative Merkley, some leases are excessive and oppressive to the point where they're almost confiscating the waterway repair and users activity, and some of those should go down and some of those must, and the division has agreed that they will, and so some revenue will be less, but there are some people not included, some are carrying users not included in lease at all, and those need to be included, and that's the reason for the inventory. And I guess my answer directly to you is some need to go up and some need to go down, but until that inventory is finished, the only comfort we find is to direct by statute between now and June 30th, 2001, that it not exceed. As I guess I indicated a little earlier, some leases expiring in that time period can be adjusted by the division. Some may be renegotiated within the time period of their lease in that time period. And so the division has some flexibility to adjust some rates. When you consider that some should go up and some should go down to try to create equity, we believe that not exceeding the revenue of this biennial period is appropriate.
I'd like
Ms. Chair, if I may, Mr. McCauley would like to make comment.
My name is Jay McCauley. I reside at 1555 North Jansen Street, in Portland, 97217. The Division City Lands proposed a freeze to the current rate structure, I believe, in early 1997. And that freeze is still in effect until, I believe, June of this year. So that is still in force at this moment in time. This particular language goes back to when the task force was still meeting. And basically what they identified during that process was that we wanted to affect the rates, the highs and the lows, and reach that equity and fairness issue, and that revenue generation was really not the focal point. And they made a recommendation as a result of the task force along these lines for that reason. And again, you know, the purpose is that, you know, we need to get a good handle on what is indeed out there, what is exempted,
yeah.
And then, of course, we can cause this program to make more sense. I hope that answers your question.
Just one more question. On the top of page 5, where you have the plus 10 years, they have a term of a lease. Where's the term of a loan coming in? What loan are we talking about?
Well,
I see. Where the structure is financed. So you're saying essentially that if a lease is being done for a place where someone has a structure that's being financed, obviously the lease has to be at least as long as the period of financing, or you can't get the financing, or you're at least under custody, and you're saying that the lease needs to be leased to turn the loan plus 10 years. Why 10 years beyond the length of the lease? I mean, beyond the length of the loan.
Chairman Welch, Representative Merkley. The idea, of course, is indeed that the term of the loan is a primary consideration. People take on these endeavors not only to pay back the loan, but to enjoy, oftentimes to enjoy some profit as a result of that. That's to provide a good rate of return and a period of time in which to do it. Now, the specific language for that, I wish I could say it was my inspiration. However, that came directly from some old language from the way the Division of State Lands used to manage this program. That specifically came from some previous language in their documents. Somewhere between 1973, 74, and today, that was omitted. I thought it was terrific language to get that rate of return, good compensation for that investment.
I have a loan. You're asking for a 40-year lease, which is an extraordinary period of time to project what the appropriate rental rate should be. I'm guessing that's why it was probably removed in the past.
Chairman Welch, Representative Merkley, I don't know if that's exactly why the division removed that in the past or sometime in the past or not. The current proposal is for a 15-year lease, which would preclude most every loan that I know of. This is a correction for that.
Okay, thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you. Appreciate it. Thanks for your indulgence, Mr.
I would like to make one brief comment, if I may. This is not so much about establishing rates, it's trying to establish some good policy in regard to management of this significant resource. It doesn't denote a change of long-term policy of the division. More than anything, I believe it's a reminder to the division that they were given responsibilities over submerged and submersible properties. Not the property next door to that, the right to carry an upland property. Their charge is still the submerged and submersible lands. The policy shift actually was a program shift that came about in the early 1970s. That's when they originally tied the upland riparian property to the program through the what they called at the time, and in fact used to this day, the extension of upland uses. That's when it appears to me, looking into the historic significance of all of this, going back to the 140-year history of the division, that appears to be where the program really took a significant turn. And the ups and downs as a result of that, I believe, stem from that period in time and from that program shift rather than the policy shift. Okay, that also, as you look deeper into the history of it, that explains the highs and the lows, the very extremes. Extremes being the extremely low side being the lawgrass, and that's explainable knowing the importance of timber logging industry to this state. Okay, but then in the same token, the highs came as a direct result of the 6% users, which are primarily the commercial and industrial users. And those are the ones that really need the adjustment more than anyone else. The ones in the middle, the marinas, moorages, the smaller operations, are indeed, as you heard last Wednesday, willing to take the hit to try to bring those highs and lows out of this. And this is a method that we can use statewide to accomplish that. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for staying late to listen to us.
Yes.
Well, we got a late start, so I'm sorry about that. The department might be comments here.
I know I stuck up for a minute. Was dash 5 being under
construction? Dash 4. The 5 are a spinoff of Ford. But they had proposed, they'd given me a fact, and I got it over to the legislative council.
So 5 is number 4 as
amended, yes.
Amended?
Yes.
So we're really addressing the dash 5.
Should be addressing 5. Because it no longer has anything to do with the common school plan, which was my recommendation. And Renee had some other proposals too to go on. Okay, do you know?
Mr. Chairman, I think I'm mixed up now. I thought I had a dash 4, now I've got a dash 4 that's been broached in concept, lines drawn through it, and paint handwritten on it.
Do you have a dash 5?
That it's a dash 5.
You don't have a dash 5?
No, I don't have.
Oh.
Well, this was the second one I got, so no wonder I can't find my place.
Well, you've been gross. I don't have that.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, to clarify, the dash 5 don't remove the common school fund, they just remove the education reserve fund that was...
Right. No, they don't have anything to do with the common school fund. No, they certainly don't remove that. We are not going there. We're not going to mess with the common school fund.
Okay. I understood.
And the interior of the bill.
That would have brought a whole lot of people's attention if we said we were getting that down.
We do not go there.
Second, Curry. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Paul Curry, Director of the Division of State Lands. Appreciate your indulgence at this late time. My letter is actually titled Dash 4 Amendments RD4, but actually it's the LC5 now. I think the only change they made was correcting the date and the inventory. And we appreciate their elimination of any further reference to Education Reserve Fund or Small School Construction Fund. Apparently that wasn't a prime purpose of the bill and allows the committee to focus then on the more substantive provisions. And there are a number of substantive provisions in here, and I think probably some unintended consequences that, in fairness to everyone, I think it's incumbent on us to point out. Question that Representative Taylor raised about the lease adoption and whether we're going to have an opportunity to grant the rate relief that we recognize is necessary, and you've heard from a number of the proponents that they believe is necessary. Under this bill, there's a freeze on the division adopting any rules regarding lease rates until the inventory is completed. So we cannot adopt the rules that we've got ready to go to the land board that would provide relief to our extension of upland uses to our rural or economically depressed locations or to our seasonally operating units. And indeed, because we can't change the existing rules, we've got a freeze in place that expires in January. And when that freeze comes off, all the automatic increases go back into place. So since we can't change rules, we can't grant relief, and increases will automatically be triggered. I don't think that was
an intended. And that was proposed for 2 years.
Right. Mm-hmm. I don't think that was an intended consequence. There's a 5% ceiling in this bill on us adjusting lease amounts. So that means that if someone comes to us to want to expand their operation, double the size of their land, we couldn't allow that. We could only allow them to increase up to 5% because we can't increase their lease amount by more than 5%. We couldn't allow conversions and uses. Should we work off of the dash five amendment,
mm-hmm.
or the
mm-hmm.
whichever one you're
dash comfortable five.
With? If you'll turn to page 4, section 3, subpart 2, division may not increase the amount of any lease under this chapter more than 5% annually. And understand that when it says lease under this chapter, this includes waterway leases, marina mortgages, this includes sand gravel operations, this includes other types of lease. Our Tongue Point lease, indeed, is a lease under this chapter. It's a lease of submersible land, and we're looking at some potential significant activities at Tongue Point that would obviously exceed this 5% limit. And our ability, because we can't grant the rate relief that we think is necessary, our ability to bring new lessees into the program is going to be constrained because they're going to want to wait until 2001 when we can adopt that relief. The revenue cap that you had raised a question on, Representative Murphy, which is down on the bottom of page 3, subsection 5, until the inventory is completed, the amount of revenue derived by the division what we received in the last 2 year period. That would prohibit us from generating any additional revenue from submerged commercial land, prohibit us from issuing new easements, prohibit us from issuing new sand and gravel leases or licenses, prohibit us from allowing expansions or conversions of existing leases, or indeed bringing in unauthorized uses, because it's not a dynamic system. Revenue from submerged commercial land includes our waterway leases, about $900,000 a year, about $500,000 a year in sand and gravel royalties. Depending on the type of economic activity, easements can generate a lot of money. I just issued an easement crossing the Willamette River for a telecommunication cable for $17,000. I've got a movie that wants to locate on submerged submersible land, the production of a movie near Rainier. And that's going to generate $20,000 or $30,000. For the revenue cap, I couldn't authorize those activities, or else I'd have to kick somebody else out of the system in order to keep things in balance. The inventory, which I can tell you, we have got no problem with doing an inventory, and we've got an inventory underway, and we fully understand the concern of those people who are currently in the leasing system that if there are unauthorized uses out there, we're going to be doing everything we can to identify them and bring them into the fold. But what we've been trying to do is focus that inventory on areas that, one, are declared state-owned, and under this bill, we'd also be inventorying what's called pending claims of navigability on any waters, and we've got 10 requests for navigability study requests, so I'd have to be out inventorying waters that the state has yet to declare ownership on, and I suspect I will make a number of friends doing that. Our effort has been to focus on areas that we actually declared a state on, where past or future development potential meets what I call a probable cause standard. I don't think that it's appropriate for us to be up and down every river, even where we own it, knock down people's doors, want to look in their backyards, if we don't have any real probable cause to think that there are structures out there. And we've got a pretty good idea of where there's structures and where they are. And then also, rather than it being an event, and we agree we need to complete this inventory of the developed areas as quickly as possible, but rather than being an event, this has got to be an ongoing process. Because this is a dynamic system. These structures get changed all the time. And so we need to commit not only to completing the inventory of the developed areas, but then to continue to update it throughout time. And that's why I'm concerned about tying any kind of rate changes to the finish of an inventory, because an inventory of a dynamic system is never going to truly be finished. Various lease program administration, Representative Murphy, you brought up a good question on how do you enter leases that allow people to borrow money on their structures, borrow money on their lease rights. In Wyoming, I was the deputy director of the farm loan program. We were the largest agricultural real estate lender in the state of Wyoming, and we issued a number of 30-year loans on 10-year leases. What we looked for was the renewability clause. And what we're proposing in our rules is a 15-year lease with a continuing right of renewability so long as the lessee's in good standing. And so it's, in essence, a lease that continues to roll over. You don't have to then continue to change your lease documents and the dates on it. And because some people will always have some kind of a mortgage against the property, they might pay that initial loan off, take a second loan, do some others. It allows the lenders to do that. And what we use here is a notice of security interest where we notify the lender if there's anything that could potentially affect his collateral interest in the lease.
Mr. Clear, is it common for folks to have a longer term for a loan than 15 years?
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, again, what lenders look for is what they call assuredness. And that assuredness either comes through a term or it comes through the renewability clause.
Now, under that renewability clause, is it renewable totally at longer in good standing, totally at the discretion of the lessee?
Right.
And at the same price?
Mr. Chair, the Representative Merkley, the lease rate, of course, adjusts over time. And you've got fixed escalators in. And what we're proposing in our new rules is to fix it for a 15-year period and fix that escalation for a 15-year period. Current rules allow the board to come in and change something 5 years down the road, and then that apply prospect will be from that day forward. So we're trying to provide certainty for a 15-year period and then examine things. And that's an extension over what we do right now. Certainly the appraisals are something that we understand people have some real concern about. Locally assessed values, we propose that we would split the cost of appraisal to allow them to challenge those locally assessed values if they want to go that route. They're not going to be forced to go that route. They can select a flat rate, and those flat rates are going to be, for our extensions of Upland, going to be substantially less than what they would be under the current rules. They can go on to the percent of gross income if they happen to be hit by a natural disaster or some kind of economic downturn or regulatory downturn. We understand the need for having an independent mediation process, and we have provided for independent mediators. We want to continue our lessee technical advisory committee, and we're stipulating a formal program evaluation. The rest of the bill provides kind of statutory guidance. I just point out that we, you know, the Constitution gives the landlord pretty clear guidance to obtain the greatest benefits to the people of the state, consistent with conservation resource under sound techniques of land management. Statutes require us to assure safety of the public, preservation of economic, scenic, and recreational values, protection of fishery, navigation, and recreation interests. We think that that gives the board pretty clear and concise language, also language that allows it to adopt a policy that can apply over 1,300 miles of rivers and streams and a 400-mile coastline. They're located all across the state. We're running a far-flung real estate program, and we've got to have the ability to match it to those local conditions. If I thought that there was a need for a bill, I'd be the first one in county to support it. I think my history has been of trying to work with bill proponents whenever it was necessary to adopt new statutes or revise existing statutes or to find an administrative route to deal with their concerns. I believe we've got an administrative route. I believe the land board and meets bi-monthly will understand the history and complexity of the program. And I can tell you, cares real deeply about citizen involvement, fairness, and equity is the appropriate body to be dealing with these lease particulars, and that's a concern that we've had with this bill from the beginning, and that's why we can't support it.
Mr. Chair. Next thing, monthly.
On page 5 of the dash 5, there's a description of an appeal panel.
Right.
That would consist entirely of people who hold leases. Can you describe what appeal process there is currently for a leasee who feels their rate is out of practice?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, our current appeal process is first an informal appeal to the director, and where we try to resolve things, and for the most part we're able to. Then we move into the contested case process, where we utilize an independent hearing officer. The facts are developed, and then it's brought before the land board. Now, to be honest with you, in the 3.5 years I've been here, we've never moved in on any of our proprietary leases into a contested case mode. We've been able to resolve things administratively. We have had on some unauthorized uses and trespass situations the need to take legal action through the courts on those, but those weren't appeals of our lessees. What we're proposing is to add between the informal director resolution another step with an independent mediator before it gets into the contested case mode, because the contested case mode is pretty formalistic and legalistic. And so that's we tried to meet this desire to have an independent mediator before it got into that. And the land board, of course, is the ultimate, has got to be the ultimate arbitrator. And I think as much as the individual appeals, there's a concern about the program and program implementation. And that's where we have said, we hear that. We need to continue this lessee advisory group that we've got in place. We need to have a formal review of this program. We think we're making changes for the good, but if we're wrong, we want to know that, and we would then want to make improvements to it. And so that's why we're going to require a 6-month report to the board and then an 18-month formal review and a survey of all our lessees and a formal evaluation report. I can tell you we've come a long way on this. We've tried to at almost every turn meet the concerns of the various lessee groups. This has been a good exercise, I think, in identifying some other concerns. We are prepared to move ahead on June 8th, and we'll let the committee know where we are on this.
Thank you. Any further questions?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Cleary, when I was meeting with the lessees, I kept hearing about the need for inventory. And I was troubled by the inventory identifying navigability issues. I think that's another can of worms that I know were addressed in a separate interim committee 2 sessions ago or something, and you can't seem to get there. But I have been impressed with our lack of maps for our waters. How are we progressing in that area?
Mr. Chair, Representative Taylor, I think we're progressing pretty well. What we've done is we're taking aerial photos, and then we're overlaying on those the adjacent land ownership using that to try to identify the potential owners of the structures, but then putting it on a geographic information system so we can do that. We'd be happy to bring some examples of those over by your office so you can see what we've got. As a matter of fact, I think we're doing some ground truthing up in your neighborhood right now. And we do have to do some ground truthing because the aerial photo is only one-dimensional shot, and you can't tell whether you're looking at in some cases, whether you're looking at the top of potentially a floating home or a dock.
I recall Mr. Pittman and others talking about the willingness of some volunteers. I saw them as guys who like to mess about in boats, perhaps being willing to assist. Is there any accommodation for that kind of help in the short process?
Ms. Chair, Representative Taylor, we're always looking to get out on the water.
Okay. Yeah. I just like to get out of the rain. Finally. Okay. No further questions. We will close the day, close our hearing on House Bill 2979. I thank the committee for their indulgence here. And so we got a late start. I'm no further business. We adjourn for the day.
That's all, guys.